and it was a nightmare because you'd do a cup of it and you'd had no idea who was coming. Mm. If any, you could open the door, no one would turn up. Your heart was in your mouth.
Born in 1973 in Kent, Mark Knight has become a household name in the world of dance music. DJ, producer, songwriter, label owner, there isn't much he hasn't done in the world of dance music.
I've got it because I love it. Mm-hmm. I genuinely love it from my heart and soul. DJing is about a psychology. How are we going to take this room with this amount of people in this environment from here to here? I know so many DJs that have just sold out for money. You're up there playing stuff that I know you don't like. Why? Why sell out music? Not everyone makes it. Of course they don't. That's the reality of life. You've got to be pretty good. You've got to come with your A game. But the door's wide open. Mm-hmm. Can you run through it? Can you make it happen?
What's up, guys, and welcome back to First Things Thirst. Bit of a change of location. We are in sunny London, and I am joined with legendary house DJ Mark Knight.
Hello, mate. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. A little bit chilly, but, you know, it's...
Welcome to London.
I'm doing all right. I've had 3 years of experience being in London, so I'm well accustomed to it.
Acclimatised by now.
Yeah. You're from London, right?
I'm from Kent initially, but I live in town now. I've always kind of flitted between the two, but yeah, it's always been my home. This neck of the woods.
And when did you actually start getting into DJing?
I guess early 90s. But you could rewind even further back from that. When I grew up in the 80s, early 80s, I was always obsessed with music. Before there was anything, DJing was a thing. Mm. I was just driven every Saturday to go and find and discover new music. So I guess if you want to go that far back, that really is the roots of DJing, is that desire and that passion to find new music. And I was always playing to my friends, oh, have you heard this? And so I guess you could rewind all the way back to, I guess, 1983, 1984, when I was 10. I'd finish playing football on a Saturday and get the bus into town and go around all the record stores and discover new music. So I guess you could go that far back. And
What was like trending back then? Because obviously I have no idea. I mean, even in the 90s, I was born in 1990. I think I really started getting into music when I was maybe like 11, 12. That's when I started to notice. I had like a passion for it. And similar to you, it wasn't just one specific type of music. I was into like loads of different genres. I just knew that when I listened to it, it made me feel good.
Yeah, that's what music should do, you know. I guess we hadn't invented the word trend in the 80s. That didn't come till a lot later on. But I mean, I was very, very lucky because I've lived through two huge cultural revolutions in music. The hip-hop in the late 70s and 80s, and then dance music in the 90s. And I was obsessed with hip-hop and soul and funk and boogie from a super early age. I guess from the age of 9 or 10, I'd sit by my mum and dad had a little alarm clock by their bed with a radio, and I'd be sat there tuning in, trying to find pirate radio stations and music that I loved, and I had a tape cassette next to it, trying to record it, that I could then go into town and say, oh, have you got this? And I know we can't even hear it. But back then it was, it was electro, hip-hop and soul and disco and all those kind of things that that first really drew me to music. Mm. And then it evolved into house music later. But that was the roots of sort of my musical foundation.
London's always been a pretty hot spot, like culturally, for music, like all sorts of music.
Always. I mean, everything happens here. And I'm going to say this with real belief. Everything, I think, in youth culture starts here. And we were so lucky that it's such a melting pot of cultural influences. And it has such an incredible energy, London. It really has all the right ingredients to be the catalyst for so many movements in culture and music. I guess you know America discovered hip hop and house, but all these things tend to take a real life here, you know. Mm. And I'm so fortunate to have grown up here and be around this music and have access to this music on my doorstep. You know, yeah. I was lucky, really lucky.
What made you get into the actual house music?
Well, I didn't get house music first. I'm not going to lie.
What was house music back then? Well, back like, did it even exist?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the earliest thing, you know, earliest sort of house record I remember hearing was probably Nitro Deluxe, Let's Get Brutal, which I think coming about 87, I'm going to say. And that was a kind of fusion of electro. I mean, it was electronically programmed, you know, synths were the leads. But that was the first kind of iterations of house music. That was where it kind of grew from. It was an amalgamation of disco and electro fused together, the tempo of disco and some of the instrumentation and melodies, and then the tech of electro. That was, I guess, the roots of how it began, and just experimenting with technology that was born in the late 80s, when you started to have drum machines and MIDI and all this access to new sounds.
Yeah, because it's not like today when you have all these software platforms that you can use to actually like create music. I guess you were a lot limited back then.
You know, let's rewind to the 70s. You never had that. You had organic instruments. You had a piano. You had a guitar. Then all of a sudden, you had all this incredible musicianship and all these new sounds. All these new sounds you'd never heard before. All these sounds you can manipulate and create from scratch. And it was just so inspiring. And so evolutionary in, around that time, that all these things were blowing up. You could take music to all these new places that had never happened before. So to grow up and be amongst that was so inspiring. And I guess really nailed on my passion to want to progress in music, I guess.
Did you start DJing or producing?
Well, like I say, DJing was never a thing as such back then. As I started to get more into house, bought a set of decks. I mean, I guess the thing that really drove me
is it Pioneer decks, or is it a different brand?
Oh, way back in the day, they were just the crappy belt-driven decks. You know, they weren't Technics. They were just, you know, whatever we could afford, which was a great grounding, really, because if you could mix on those, which took a whole lot of jiggling and it was a very tactile experience. If you could make it work on then on that equipment, you know, you had skills, and you know, the better the equipment got, the easier it became, the better you could become. So I was very much driven by my brother, who actually learned to DJ first, and we're so competitive. We always have been, and we still run the label together now. And he's like, oh, I can DJ, I can do it. I'm like, what? Right, that's it. Now, you know, I being the older brother as well, and already, you know, buying music before him, I thought, well, this can't happen. So that kind of, that drove me to hone my skills technically in terms of being a DJ. That was around 91, 92, around that sort of time. And it progressed from there on.
Were you able to make any money out of it to begin with, or was it just purely a hobby?
Purely a hobby. And that's how, you know, it should really be fundamentally underpinned with that as an ethos, to do it because you absolutely love it. You know, money's a byproduct. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that sentiment has got distorted and lost nowadays. I guess when you see people jumping off, you know, often on private planes and living this kind of high rolling lifestyle off the back of it, you know, you need to rewind it all the way back to being, to go, this just should be about a love for music. I never got into DJing because I wanted money. No chance. There was no money. It was just a pure passion to play music to people that you love, to express yourself through the medium of playing music, not because I needed money. I had a job. I had to go to work. And then,
what was your job before you doing this full time?
When I left school, I was in construction, and that was always the plan. Well, that and football. I always wanted to be a professional footballer, but it didn't quite happen. That was always the game plan. But going out, girls, and a whole bunch of other things turned up, and you know. Yeah, it was getting harder and harder to turn up to football on Sunday morning. So, yeah, that didn't quite happen. So I was, you know, I was in construction as well at the same time, and I was making, and then started to make a bit of music and get some gigs locally. And it sort of progressed from there, really. But
I think that's probably the hardest part when you start off, actually finding places to get gigs at.
Like, absolutely.
How I'm trying to imagine me, if I was starting DJing, how would I go about trying to get those first few gigs?
You have to generate your own audience. That's what it's all about. is about going to a venue and say, look, I will bring you X amount of people. Mm-hmm. It's that organic initial swell that gives you that momentum to start. And it's about rallying all your friends. Back then,
because how do you do that before social media?
Before social flyers. You'd have to go around with word of mouth, telling people. We used to go around to clubs afterwards and put flyers on people's windscreens. Mate, it was old school. But there was a charm and a passion about that. I mean, it was a nightmare because you'd do a club event and you'd had no idea who was coming. Mm. If any, you could open the door, no one would turn up. Your heart was in your mouth.
Yeah, I was going to say, like,
there was no pre-sales.
You're blagging it to the club.
It was just like, fingers crossed it's a work. But it was about building your own audience initially. I mean, a lot of that was your friends, getting your friends down there to help support you. They tell a friend, it's a successful night, it goes well, and it kind of ripples out and it grows from that way. But I remember my first ever gig was on a Tuesday night in a pub in Maidstone. That's where it started. It
was, how many people?
Five. But that's where you learn how to DJ.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
Look, anyone can play to 5,000 people because they're not going anywhere. We'll yeah. bought a ticket for 50 quid.
They're probably off their nut as well.
You're not going anywhere. Yeah. Play to five people, get one record wrong, they're going. They're mm-hmm. going home. So that's, in some ways, they're the best environments to learn because it really teaches you to think about how you play music and the progression of it and not playing things that jar with the situation you're in. So all of those tiny little gigs playing to no one was really the best training, the best foundation I could have for my career, because I can always go back to that. And you see a lot of these kids now who stratospherically kind of get propelled into this realm of stardom that have none of that grounding. So they don't know how to really manipulate and work a crowd from nothing. I mean, I love playing gigs where I start and I play open to close. I play the whole night. So you start with the first person walks in the door to everyone leaves. And you build that story. You kind of grow it over the night in line with the energy of the room. Mm-hmm. And that's what DJing's about.
Yeah.
You know, DJing is about rocking up for an hour playing all the hits. My mum can do that. Yeah. I could teach my mum to do that in an hour.
It's interesting because a lot of comedians do that. The comedians actually like to go and play in the smaller clubs so they can refine and practice their skills.
You get a feel, you know. DJing is about a psychology. It's about going into a room and going, okay, the vibe of the room is here and what I want it to be is here. Mm-hmm. So how are we going to take this room with this amount of people in this environment from here to here without it feeling completely effortless, without mm-hmm. anything jarring, no peaks and troughs in energy, this smooth ride musically to the point of where I want it to be. Mm-hmm. And that's what DJing's about. And in those small rooms, it's easier to get that personal connection. When you're in a massive warehouse, you lose touch of that because mm-hmm. you're initially there's a disconnect in that relationship because they are behind a barrier 30 feet away. So how am I supposed to connect with that? Mm-hmm. How am I supposed to connect? And especially in this day and age where people look at you, like, I still can't quite get my head around that. I'm like, why are you looking at me? Hang on, what's going on? It's like, you should be just listening to the music. When I went out as a kid, we weren't interested in looking at some geezer stood behind the decks. We went out to look at girls and dance, you know? And that, again, that bit's, I think, got a bit distorted and lost in the kind of evolution of electronic music. I think it needs to be more about, don't worry about what the DJ is. You don't need a cue for fun. You don't need to look at me to say, right, I'm going to put my hands up and everyone have fun. Mm-hmm. Like, you should be lost in the environment that you're in and the music you're in. You don't need a prompt from me. But mm-hmm. it's turned into that and that's the game you play. But, yeah, I still find that a bit weird.
It is. I mean, I remember when I started going to clubs, and particularly the first few times I went to Ibiza, I think I was like 17, 18 years old. And I had some old footage on a digital camera, which I had, because obviously phones didn't have videos then. And I was watching them the other day, and there is nobody holding a phone.
There was no such thing.
Nobody.
Yeah.
Like, everybody's like properly just like in the zone and just with everybody else.
Yeah.
And the sad thing is, we're probably never going to go back to that.
It's such a shame. I know I have this conversation a lot. I mean, all the best memories are in your mind. Mm-hmm. You know, no one's ever, oh, let me just get out the phone and dial back to 2012. No one said that ever. Do you know mm-hmm. what I mean? So if we could lose that and just be in the moment, mm-hmm. that would make things great again. I really believe that because we had so many brilliant times. I haven't got a single photo to back that up. That statement, not one. The one doesn't, thank God, to be fair, for legal reasons. But they're all the best nights you ever had, and they're all there, you know. And yeah. I think we need to shift culture and trends away from being so dependent on that. And, you know, so I'm almost under pressure to portray what you're doing and where you are, just be in the moment. Because it's so much better.
I think the only way they could really do that is if, like, on entry, you have to put your phone away.
Yeah, I mean, there are clubs, I know in Germany, that have that as a policy.
Oh, is that the, what's it called? The
I'm not sure the name, but that's such a great idea. Because, honestly, back in the day, I guess everyone looks at things retrospectively through sort of tainted spectacles, but they were brilliant times. They were brilliant because you had to be in it. There was no second chance. There was no replays. You were in the moment, you know. And it's a shame we've kind of lost that as a thing.
Yeah. Going back to when you say in your DJing, I've always been fascinated by how you have that ability to manipulate the crowd. So tell me a bit more about how you change their energy. Like you said, you wanted to get from like where they are now to this point which you want to get them to. How do you go about doing that? Like what's going through your mind when you're thinking about, okay, I'm going to play this track next and then this track next? How does it work?
It's about knowing your music and the energy related to that record. And if you put them in a sequence, what story does that tell over a time span? Now, if you're planning an 8-hour set, you've got to know enough music that's relevant for hour one, hour two, hour three, hour four, and that they all join up. Like, to give you an example, let's say you're at a disco, like a wedding, and someone's DJing, everyone's dancing about, and then the DJ puts the wrong record on. Oh, even your nan sat down. Even your nan's not feeling the vibe. It's killed her buzz, you know? So that's a kind of a very extreme example of it, but it's about knowing your music inside out so you don't get that as an outcome. You get a natural progression, and you need to know when to ramp it up, back it off a bit, because if you go on all the time, people are like, I'm worn out.
It's too much
energy. If it's not enough energy,
it needs to be like the high track and then like maybe like low and then back to the high.
You have to know there's sometimes you need to flip it and take them out of a certain groove. But it's all that psychology of just being connected to the room, knowing, okay, I can push the envelope for this long because I can, you know, you're looking around, you feel people's energy. Mm-hmm. It's all about that, you know. It's about just picking up on that, understanding where you think they're at. And that just comes through experience. You know, you can't teach anyone that. Yeah. It goes back to the days of playing on a Tuesday night in Maidstone where there's five people in there going, all right, I need to think about every single record here. I can't make one mistake because otherwise I'm playing to the bartender. Mm-hmm. So it goes back to that basic premise of just understanding your records, picking and choosing them so you create this seamless flow of energy.
Do you have all these tracks in your head or is it all like organized in the... Because I've seen DJs, they have like the I don't know if they still have that, but they had a booklet of like...
Yeah, I mean, we don't use CDs so much now, but you have playlists within CDJs that you can kind of organize into a flow. And, you know, I do that. It makes sense. You know what I mean? It's too much to be in that high-pressured environment and be prepared to fully understand know every single record. Mm-hmm. So I put them into different hours. I put them into like hour one, hour two, hour three. And I know that they're relative to the energy. If I'm playing a 2-hour set, I've got like two or three hours of stuff that's relevant, that's new. A lot of my records in there for some classics that people want to come and hear me play. Things that are not out, so that it placates people that want to come and hear brand new unreleased music. So you have to kind of get all that balance and have it in an order that makes sense as a story, because the story has to have a start, a middle, and an end.
Yeah.
You know, like every great concert you go to, you know, no one starts. You don't go and see U2 and they do with or without you first. You're like, oh, we're going to go now. You've done it. Well, see ya. You know, that you work to that point. It's the finale of the set. So you program it accordingly, that it tells a story pro rata to the length of the set you're playing.
Did you ever play tracks that you hate, but you know it's going to get the crowd hyped?
No, never, ever, 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 ever. I don't you know, like I said to you, I didn't get into music for money. I got in it because I love it. Mm-hmm. I genuinely love it from my heart and soul. So you couldn't pay me enough money to go and play something I didn't like. And that notion, I know so many DJs that have, and I'm going to call it, have just sold out for money. And yeah. I know you're up there playing stuff that I know you don't like. Mm. Yes, you're getting paid ridiculous amounts of money, but like, why? Why sell out music? That's like got to be the worst crime in the world, right?
Mm.
You know, if you want to go and earn money, go into banking or go into something where you don't have that kind of moral situation. Like, I could have gone on a lot further in my career, been a lot bigger than what I am, but I couldn't sell myself out and sell music out.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. I don't go hungry. I live a great life. And I can stand behind everything I've done and tell my grandkids I did things that I believed in and I did it from my heart. And what more do I need to say?
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? That's it. Full stop.
Yeah, I remember I went to Tomorrowland, I think it was in 2019, and on the main stage, I mean, that's where they're playing to tens of thousands of people.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people. And the music they play is a bit like, I mean, let's just say it's not my type of music. But these DJs are getting paid. I mean, I don't know if they enjoy playing that music or not, but they're getting paid like crazy amounts of money to do so.
And look, there are, when you go into bigger settings, obviously, you've got more crowd, less chance of everyone being completely...
It's got to be like mainstream, isn't it?
Yeah. So look, I get bending things to accommodate the situation. But when you kind of go off into a realm of doing things that doesn't come from the heart, then I don't understand it. I don't get it. Maybe I come from an era that was pre all of this. You know, there were no DJ courses. There were no, now it's a full on trade, a profession. It was just a love. So I'm still rooted in that element of how I see it. So I don't get it.
I respect that.
Thank you. It's the only way to be, surely, right?
Mm. Do you recall a point in your career where you thought, fucking hell, like I've made it here?
No.
Or has it been
gradual? Yeah, it's been, I mean, I guess that's why I've had the career I've had, because it's never gone up like that. It's always been this just general ascent to, and the thing I hate doing in life is going backwards.
Mm.
Like I can't go backwards. I can't, like, it kills me to do anything backwards. It can be small steps, but always forward. And I've never had this huge hit that's kind of gone like this. But usually off the back of that, it comes straight down like this.
Yeah, you don't want to be one hit wonder.
No,
yeah.
I mean, having a hit is a big burden to carry, because
the expectation is so high.
What are you going to do next? You know what I mean? It's all good doing it once, but can you do it again? Can you do it again? And I've done things that, I love, that sometimes connect on a very big scale, and sometimes just allow me to kind of progressively move forward in steps that don't go backwards, but just continually go up and up and up and up. And I've kind of had the career over that period, because I've not had these huge peaks and troughs in my career. And 25 years later, still doing, still with that at the top of my game.
I think what made you stand out to me, or when I realized who you were, I think it was when Man with the Red Face came out. Because this was when I was at university. I think it was second year of university. Was it 2009?
Eight, yeah.
2008, 2009. Yeah. So I was going out a lot. This was in Newcastle.
Right.
So every time I went out, there was always a guarantee that that song was going to get played at least once. And every time it came on, like, me and my friends always got like really hyped, because it never got old. Like, it was such a sick track.
Oh, thank you. I mean, I guess that was, that's been my biggest record in my career. And
bigger than Downpipe?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Because it kind of crossed over to a mainstream audience, but without having a mainstream approach. And that's the sweet spot. If you can do that, then you really win on every level. Downpipe is, and thank you for bringing up, is a headsy record, and if you know.
That's, to me, that's like proper house.
Thank you.
Like, gets me in a good, like, anytime I want to go out, I always used to listen. That would be like one of the songs that was in the playlist.
Oh, nice one. Thanks, man. I mean, yeah, that took a long time to get right. That took nearly a year to get that record right. I remember.
What, because of the vocals or the...
Just the whole production and just the pressure. Like, if you're going to work with Underworld, mate, you've got to come correct. You can't get nearly right. You've got to nail it. And I remember playing at Amnesia for Cream in Ibiza, and I played it for the first time. And I kid you not, Mike, it cleared the dance floor. I was like, oh, shit. What have I done here? I've made a record with Underworld, and it's cleared the dance floor.
Really?
Yeah, it did. Because it's different. It's kind of very progressive arrangement. It's a very clever record. It sort of tells a story over 8 minutes. It wasn't quite right, so we refined it before. Do you know what? I'm going to stick with it. I know this record's right. You might not get it straight away. And now, in 2024, we're still talking about it. And it's because we sort of stuck to our guns. Go, do you know what? The idea of this is right, and it's not an instant thing. It's a grower, and it creeps up on you. But those are the ones that last the test, you know, the test of time. So,
I was always curious to know, like, you know, man with the red face, like the guy who's playing the sax.
Yeah,
how that seems like it was the perfect way, whatever you would call it, that segment of sax.
Yeah,
like I don't think it could have got better. Like, how many times did it take for him just to be like improvising?
Well, that's not one take. So what we did, when you get someone in like that who's going to give you a solo, you get him to jam.
So you don't tell them, you just say, just do your thing.
Yeah, so look, we need a 16-bar jam here that leads into a crescendo, the bit at the end. So he'll do four or five takes, and then we'll just cut up all the bits. Excuse me. And shall I do that again? Excuse me. He'll do about four or five takes, and then we'll cut it together to get the perfect melodic flow. So... James is brilliant, the guy James might have done, and I love him to bits. But yeah, that was about four or five takes. Some incredible, look, if he didn't come up with all the magic, we couldn't have pieced it together. But generally, a lot of those things are an amalgamation of different takes produced by us to tell that, to that little bit of a, to make that phrase. So
it must be such a good feeling, you know, when you've got the final version, and you're like, it's fucking done. And this is going to... Well, I guess you never really know how it's going to be received.
No, you don't. But no, I mean, you got an indication based on experience, yeah. But sometimes you're like, holy shit, I wasn't expecting that.
Did you ever get sick of it because you've heard it so many times? Because I know when...
Mate,
even
if
sometimes,
I had a pound for every time I played for that, I'll... Yeah.
Whenever I used to edit my own videos, and I would pick a particular song, and I was trying to get it right, like the edit, and that song was repeating over and over and over again to the point where I started to hate the song.
Yeah. I think when you're making a record, if the idea is super strong, and that's the fundamental, that's the main essence of it, getting the idea right. If you get the idea right, it'll come together in about 3 or 4 hours because the idea is strong. If you've got to try and engineer it into a product, then it's not the right idea. You know, if you've got to kind of crowbar parts into a record to make them fit, you've got the wrong parts. It's not the right idea. Stop. And then move to something else. So, yeah, there are times back in the early days where the ideas weren't strong enough. You'd spend ages and think, oh, I hate this. But the more experienced you get, the more confident you are, and the quicker the process is, because you're going in with a stronger idea. I go, I know this idea is going to work. It's this, and it's done.
How do you get the ideas? Like, do you just think, oh, yeah, I have an idea to do this track? Like, maybe it's... at night when you're lying in bed, or maybe after you've done a set and you're like, oh.
All of that, yeah. Sometimes you'll play and you'll hear something and you're mixing two records, you go, hang on, that's an idea. Or you hear someone else play something, oh, that's an idea. You know, inspiration, it never switches off. I'm constantly inspired by everything. I'll be in a taxi, someone's playing something on the radio, oh, I'm constantly on Shazam.
Just hear like little
all
noises.
All the time, I hear something, oh, that's a good idea. That's a good shout. Or that's a good idea for a record. So, yeah, that element never ever switches off. My brain is always on for inspiration. And I mean, touch wood, I've never run out of ideas. I've never had writer's block. I just haven't got enough. There's not enough release slots in a year to get all the ideas out that I could write. You know, in some ways it sort of stifles me because you're like, I could do 50 tracks, you know, I could do 100 tracks. It just on and on and on. Yeah, I'm just very lucky to.
How do you find the balance between being in the studio producing versus going out and about being the DJ? Real quick, guys, I just want to share with you something which I spent the end of 2023 putting together for you. You see, in life, if you are unhappy with something, you need to change it. That is one of the core philosophies that has driven me, my businesses, and my fitness over the past 10 years. In recent years, I've been asked frequently how I've managed to go from being an average personal trainer, working all day, every day in a gym in the north of England, to the position that I am in today. That is why I decided to create the Digital Playbook. This is a step-by-step blueprint for anybody who finds themselves in the same position that I did years ago, wondering to myself, how can I make money online? Can I really make a full-time income from creating content about the things that I actually like? How can I travel the world, work from my laptop, and at the same time still afford to live a great lifestyle? It's essentially a playbook on how I built multi-million pound businesses off the back of creating content online. If you want to check it out, head over to thedigitalplaybook.net and you can book in a call with my team to find out more. Let's get back to the episode.
Well, I mean, it's, I have to juggle a lot of things. I'm a DJ, I'm a producer, I've got a big record label. I tend to have about 3 or 4 days a month to write music, and that's it. Because I'm so quick at doing it, and I know...
You just go into the studio and then...
Bang, do it in a day, done. And then I bro test it and I make tweaks, but it doesn't take me any longer than that.
Okay.
If it does, it's not quite right. I suppose... Over the time, I make it, get an initial idea to a place where I can go and play it one day, and then there'll be 3 or 4 hours worth of tweaks. But that's come through 25 years worth of experience. I mean, some things take a little, if you've got to use a lot of musicians, just the process of recording it, editing vocals, that can take a bit longer. But if I was just to do a straight club record, yeah, a day. So I maybe only take one or two, about 3 days a month in the studio. The rest of the time it's running the business, to be honest. Yeah. That is the biggest element of my week or my month. Is that, because I spend more time working on other people's music than I do my own. I spend a lot of time on ad prod, on the music that we sign. That consumes most of my energy. Most of my energy is given on other people's work to build the profile and the success of Tool Room.
So how did Tool Room Records come about?
Well, it was born really out of the experiences I'd had releasing music on other people's labels. And I just felt really let down by the whole process. Mm-hmm. I was like, these people can run a bath, let alone a record label. You know, I could do this better. And I had no idea how to, there was no, here's how you start a record label, volume one, the book, you know, we just made it up. But I believed in what I wanted to say musically. I had an identity, and I think fundamentally that's key, is to know what you stand for. That's the secret of success in any type of music, is to stand behind what you are and just stick with it. You know, if you believe in something, you do it with pure transparency and love, you'll always be doing the right thing, because that says you. If you try to copy things or you know, follow trend, that's when it begins to go wrong. So it was born out of an idea that I had to own the process, really, because I felt that if I'm going to be successful here, I can't leave my career in the hands of other people. I need to take ownership of this, because if it goes wrong, it's only me to blame. I look inwardly, you know, I can't blame. If things don't happen, then it's down to me to work harder, work smarter, whatever it needs to be. If I need to get through that wall, then I better start running. You know, I'm not going to let someone else, no one's going to do it for me. So I better own the process. So I realised early on that I knew what I wanted to stand for. I knew if I built the right team around me that I could say something. I could really say something. And the stars aligned very early. My brother, who was working as a car salesman at the time, lost his job. And I said, come on, sure, let's start a record label. And my dad had just retired at the time as well.
Did he like music as well?
Well, he'd been in music as well. I mean... when he left school, he was a drummer and he was in a band and they toured and they were quite successful. So he'd been in the music business. He was an artist. He went on into other businesses and did what, and music was a long time ago, but he was always passionate about music. He'd been in the scene, you know, loosely. So he understood how it worked a little bit and he had a real passion for it. So we sat down and I said, look, Dad, I want to start a record label, can you give us some, you know, help? And he brought a different perspective to it. You know, we were very close to the business in terms of the passion for the specifics and nuances of what we wanted to achieve, but he brought the business acumen to it. It's like, look, we could be selling washing machines here, lads. The fact we're selling music is somewhat irrespective. We need to apply certain principles to the way we apply ourselves to how we do business if we want to be successful and have longevity. So we underpinned it and all the right business acumen. And I think if you get those two factors right, if you have a passion and creativity and you marry that with great business principles, you've got a good chance of winning.
Mm-hmm.
And we had all of those things. And we stuck to a plan. We wrote out a five-year plan initially, and we were hemorrhaging money left, right, and centre. But we believed in it. We never, ever gave up. In fact, I don't think we made any money for 13 years. Everywhere, anything we made, we piled back into the business, into premises, into more staff, more and more staff. You know, we had 40-odd staff at one time. I think we're still at 33 now. But we believed in it wholeheartedly, and we stuck to what our initial vision was. It was born out of a shed that's on my parents' house. That's why it's called Tool Room. It's where we used to keep the lawnmower and all the garden tools. The tool room. It was just a brick building outside my mum and dad's house. And I was at work, and I was doing a little bit of DJing, and I had a flat in town. And I said to my wife, look, I want to take the plunge and go full-time and start this label and just throw everything at it. I've got one chance. I'm at the point in my life where I've got nothing to lose. So we sold the flat, and every penny I had, I ploughed into this business, and I built a studio inside the tool room. So we said, well, what are we going to call it? And I said, well, I guess the soul of this business is this room, so let's call it Tool Room. It's a very personable thing to our family, although it's only a shed. And that was that was how it began, and that's the name behind the story.
What is the role of a record label? Because I'm trying to imagine, if I'm a DJ, I've just created a track.
Yep.
Like, you can't just release the track. Do you have to have it on a label, and then the label has a responsibility to push it out there?
Correct, yeah. In its most basic form, that's right. What we do is we find talent, we find music, we work on bringing that music to be the best it possibly can be, with, if we need, advice, extra production, to taking that product to the best product it can possibly be. Then we create a marketing plan around that record. How do we give that record exposure? How do we get eyes and ears on the product? So we come up with a marketing plan specific to that record. And then we deliver it to all the DSPs, all the Spotify and Apple and so on and so forth. And then we continue to update them. So, and then we've got an events business. We look after the artists with shows. So we're like a kind of 360 ecosystem around an artist to help support them, so they can concentrate on being artistic. We can look after the business aspect of, because it's called the music business for a reason. It's not all music and it's not all business. You have to have, both facets well and truly well placated for it to really to work and be on song. So we look after the business side of it, and then we pay people, we look after people, we make sure that they generate money through every possible option in music now, because technology is just evolving constantly, and the opportunities to exploit music are ever changing. For example, Peloton is one of our biggest clients. They're supplying music to Peloton for their...
What's Peloton?
Peloton, on the bikes.
Oh, right,
We got the screen and you...
exercise thing.
Yeah.
Oh, I should know that.
But that's how music's evolving. It's about being across all of these new opportunities.
Like TikTok now.
Yeah, all of these things need, all of these platforms need music, or they need product. And we need to be across that. We need to make sure we've got our product there. We're shouting very loudly that you should listen to our stuff. So that's in the most basic form, the role of a label.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a big difference, between a record label and a record company. Look, we could start a record label now. Go, right, let's call it Cushion Record Label. We're off and running, signs of music. But to have a record company with staff and expertise is a different entity, and we're very much a record company, and we're super at the top of our game.
Well, last year, 2023, on Beatport, you were the
number one label. Yeah, I think we've been for years and years. It's great. We're 20, celebrate 20 years. And it was a nice little nod to say, hey, we're still top of our game. 20 years later,
who was one of the the best signings that you made as a company?
I guess that varies, really. You know, people we've worked with over a long period of time. We've signed some big superstars. We've done records from anywhere from Coldplay to David Guetta, right the way through to, you know, kids out of their bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
There are no rules. We don't A&R with our eyes, we A&R with our ears. And it's about, it doesn't matter where you come from and who you are.
There's no specific genre.
There's a specific genre musically, but in terms of artistically, yes, it helps if you're David Guetta. Of course it does.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're Johnny Smith in your bedroom and you've come up with a banger, you've come up with a banger.
Yeah.
We're the home of bangers. And that's that underpins everything we do is finding that, the right music, you know, within a specific sound, because again, as I said earlier, it's about knowing what you stand for, that people go to your music, your go-to, without even always listening to it.
Mm.
When we used to have record shops, you used to have certain labels, you'd go in there and you'd see the label would be the artwork, you'd see the vinyl, and I'll have another one then. Do you want to hear it? No, it's cool. I know it's going to be great. I'll just take it.
Yeah.
And it's getting to that point where people trust you that much. They see the new pack shot and go, I'll have that, new Tool Room release, we'll have that.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, a consistency of sound and quality over a period of time.
Do you find talent, or does the talent come to you? Like, do they submit their songs to Tool Room, or is it Tool Room's job to actually go find new people?
Both. You know, it's a scouting process all the time. One thing we have developed in the last 8 years is we have our own academy, which is an educational business, and that kind of training ground, much in line with the academy system in football. That was the initial idea. You know, mm-hmm. I've come through that and understood that process really well,
mm-hmm.
and thought, look, we can replicate this in music, because it's a kind of win for all. We can teach you the real specifics of making our sound. It's not a generalized music production, because listen, you go on YouTube and everything you want to know is there for free.
Yeah,
crack on. Now, if you want to learn the specifics of making the sound of Tool Room, we can give you all the inside intel on how to do so. And you're taught by artists that have had real bona fide high-end careers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a bit like going to a football training camp, go, right, today we're doing shooting with Pele. You know, it's a bit different to logging on to YouTube. We've got artists like Dean Ramirez, who, you know, who I wrote Downpipe with, teaching you how to make the specifics of our sound. So you're learning from the very, very best. You create a relationship with us. There's a direct conduit between what you're doing and the record label. And if you're good enough, we'll sign you and mm-hmm. you're on the label. And if you're not, at least you've learned from the best of the best. So it's a great model that feeds into the ecosystem of how we find artists. You know, look, not everyone makes it. Of course they don't. That's the reality of life. I mean, you look at the football academy system, it's 1% of the 1% that make it.
Mm.
And it's a bit like that in music. I'm not going to lie. You've got to be pretty good. You've got to come with your A game. But the door's wide open.
Mm-hmm.
Can you run through it? Can you make it happen? And we'll give you all the tools to at least try. So that's a big part of our scouting process. Of course, we have artists globally that we're friends with that make the sound of what we do. We have relationships. We put them in recording contracts. So it's a kind of multi-faceted approach to how we get music. But we need to be across all of it if we want to be the best of the best.
How does it make money?
Through downloads, through neighbouring rights. There's so many different options now to generate money, you've got to be across all of it. It's a tough market, because not only is the ticket price very low, like, for example, if you stream a record on Spotify, you get 0.02 pence for every stream. Now, you've got to do a lot of streams to make any money.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean to say you can't. You just got to have great music, and you've got to have a lot of it.
What happens when you download a song?
You get the money, you get the sale of that. You make more money via that.
Because I download the majority of the songs I listen to on my iPhone.
Yeah.
But then it technically no longer becomes a stream, does it?
No, then you bought it, then you own it. That's your copy of the record. So, and then
But I've not bought it, though. I've just downloaded it.
Ah, now.
Like, if I've downloaded something on Spotify.
Well, it depends where you've downloaded it from. See, that's the challenge we face, because I would say conservatively, we're working on the basis of every record we, one record we sell, let's say 1,000 are downloaded illegally. Now, let's say we open the jean shop. So if I'm going to open the jean shop, for every pair of jeans we sell, someone's going to come in the shop and nick 1,000 pairs.
Fuck.
You know?
Well, this is from like the torrent sites, like Pirate Bay.
All of that thing. You're working, you're running. It's very, very tough. I mean, when things went digital.
Don't do it, guys. Don't buy them.
If you're listening at home, cut that out. So it's tough. You're running uphill and you've got to run fast. But I think with the growth of Spotify and Apple and Deezer and all these sites now, and music becoming more affordable and more well organized, you know, if you subscribe to Spotify, you've got every.
I've got my own playlist. I've got there's an Ibiza playlist which has, I think it's got like, where is it, like 50,000 followers on it.
Yeah,
you got 10 of your songs on there.
Oh, thanks, mate. Well, there you go. You put it back. Love that, Mike. but that there is, you know, now we've shifted to that model that people know, well, if I pay £10 a month, I can have every record ever made. I mean, as a kid growing up, that would be like the biggest dream ever. Yeah. I mean, I pay £10 for one record, let alone every record ever made. Yeah. But still not everyone's there. It's still a long way before we go back to the heady days of physical product where there were no pirated music, you know. We made a lot. Well, it was just pre-tour room, so unfortunately, we just missed that heyday. But you know, when you're selling a CD or a vinyl for £18, you're making a lot of money. And that's the only way of consuming it. When they were selling millions and millions of albums at £20, it's a lot of money.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, we're in a different landscape now. It's great that people can have access to it. That needs to be married with a conscience to support music, to give it longevity.
But most of the DJs, they're buying songs from people. That's like the main one.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, not everyone does still. People, you know, people sharing music, people still buying, downloading it from illegal sites. And
I'd feel pretty bad if I was a big-time DJ and I didn't support my mate.
I'd feel very bad. Yeah, I think if you've got a conscience and you want this scene to be as best as it can, it's about putting back. You know, I've never, I can hand on my heart, so I've never downloaded an illegal piece of music. Why would I, you know, I love this scene. I love it. I want it to grow and continue. Why would I rob it? So, and it's not that expensive to buy something from Beatport now. It's £1. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
I mean, the amount of work that goes and love and passion that goes in to making that piece of music, if you can't spend £1, maybe you should be, you know, thinking about something else.
Which track made you the most money on Beatport?
On Beatport, I mean, Red Face made us a lot of money on Beatport.
You split that 50-50 and the bit to the sax man.
James gets a lot of gigs out of that. we made a lot of money out of that. That was pre-streaming. I mean, streaming makes us a lot more money now than Beatport.
Something like Spotify?
Spotify, yeah. Spotify is our biggest revenue generator by a long way.
For you personally, and then for
with
tour
the
label, room,
for tour room, yeah, yeah. We you know, we do what, 8 million streams a week, 10 million. Streams
so every week. Release from tour room, you will get like a cut, which you, as the company, keeps, and then you will dish out some to the.
Yes, that's right. The DJ. Yeah, that's right. There's a percentage split between label retention and artist. So yeah, and the main thing is where this industry tends to go wrong is there's too many record labels, not enough record companies. And no one really gets paid. But where we have paid everyone since day one, every single penny they're owed. Because if I don't pay you, how can I go back and say, can I have another one?
You get a bad reputation
chance.
As well.
Yeah, no chance, Mark. But there's so many record labels that don't adhere to that, and it's a shame because that doesn't help the support the scene at all.
I was going through YouTube last night because I was curious to know, like, what bangers are actually from tour room. So I went on the YouTube channel and I arranged it as like from the most popular views. I think the one that has the most views, 14 million, Technasia and Green Velvet, Sugar.
Sure, yeah.
14, and then 7 million and 5 million, you got, what's his name, Weiss?
Weiss.
Feel My Needs.
Yeah.
That is like my anthem for Ibiza, I think. It's such a,
it's just a great song. Record, yeah. I mean, both of those records, when you talked about, for like I wouldn't have said they would have grown to be the records. They were real surprise records. I mean, Phil Money's just still going. I mean, that's the record that's probably made us the most money ever, that.
Really? Yeah. And then Slash and Dope.
Yep.
That Anguilla.
Well, yeah, do you know?
3.4 million views for that one.
Okay.
But that's a banger, though. The steel drums are...
Yeah, I mean, that's just on our channel. I mean, a lot of people, you'll go to a lot of other sites that, you know, that have used our music.
Well, there's one with yours, Your Love. The original club mix, 14 million views on some random channel.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that
that's quite a bit of ad revenue money, that.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's our job as the record label to be across all of that, to find all that money, again, to pay the artists. That's what a record company does. Mm. We have to be across every opportunity to generate money for the artists. Go and collect that money, have relationships, have accounts with all these platforms so that we can, you know, look after the artists.
So even if that's on another channel, you still get the ad revenue from it?
Yeah, we do.
Okay. And then you've got a few other ones, obviously Downpipe, Cody, I Feel It, Into My Life, and Man with the Red Face. You know, I was wondering that you've got the one which I used to listen to a lot, the Sandcastles, and you've got the Love, that Florence and the Machine remix.
Yeah.
Why is that not on Spotify? Clearance.
It's a good question. It's Florence and Machine. Because we licensed that. In fact, the reason how we did that record was to generate revenue. All the profits we gave to that. At the time when that happened, there was a big tsunami in Japan. Mm. My wife's best friend is Florence's manager. And she's known Florence forever and ever. In fact, when Florence was starting, my wife used to drive around to do all pub gigs in South London. Mm. And we were just chatting. I said, we should probably do something about this. I said, look, give me the parts to You Got the Love and I'll do something with it. And we gave all the proceeds to the tsunami appeal in Japan. So I think that's probably a licensing thing because we just licensed the parts off of, I can't remember if it's Sony or whoever, to do that. So maybe they've not re-uploaded it, which is a shame. Cause
it is a shame because that needs to be on my playlist.
I'll look into that.
How do you ever find you have issues with licensing if you heard some vocals from like an old song and you were like, oh, I want to use those vocals in this modernized house track that I want to do? You have to get permission from them to use the vocals.
Yep.
And then they might say yes, no, maybe.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because that Alex Wan, he had a hit last year, the Milkshake song with Khalees. And I think they were in... clearly it wasn't on Spotify for a while, but I think now Khalees has been like, okay, yeah, you can use the vocals, and then now it's on Spotify, and then she must, I assume, get a cut from the revenue that
No, you have to do it. A lot of labels don't do that, but because we're so present and we're so focal that and it's not ethically, it's not the right thing to do. You know, if someone was to go and sample my work and not pay me, I'd be a little bit pissed off, I'm not going to lie. So, yeah, we go through the process. We've got a business affairs team in the office that that look after that. If someone uses a sample, we'll then approach the people who own the sample. And then there's two halves of a record. So you've got the master side, which is the actual audio. So let's say you sung a song and I wanted to sample it. That's great, love that, Mark, I'm going to sample. But you didn't write it. Say Jasper wrote it, right?
Oh.
So I'd have to go to you or whoever owns the master site, we'll call the master site at the audio, and say, is it okay we can use it? And you're like, yes, you can. It's 10 grand to use it and you pay us this royalty, right? Then I'll go to Jasper and say, can we clear the publishing side? And he'll take a percentage. So there's two parts of a record.
Mm.
And
again, so it can get pretty expensive.
It can get very expensive.
It's better off just finding someone to do the vocals in the studio.
Correctamundo. That is the. But the kind of view on that has changed a lot because initially it was like, no, we don't want to do it. It's loads and loads of money. But now people realise that it's a great way of reinventing them as an artist.
Yeah,
it's a great way to generate money without doing anything. You know, people have become less obtrusive in terms of their position on clearing things and more open to doing things. Some people are pretty, you know, are pretty hardcore about it. It's a straight no. A lot of time, or they'll say, I'll take 100%. and they're in every right to, because if it's their piece of music, you know, you can be like that. But it's become easier to clear samples now than it was back in the day. Back in the day, it was just a process that could take years. You know, if there was 10 people writing a record, you had to go to them and say someone had died. Then you had to go to their estate. It was long.
Yeah.
It was a very, very long process. It's a lot more streamlined now, and people are more receptive to that as a concept.
Talking about songs coming back, you know that that viral video of, I think it was Mustafa, who's doing that dance when he gets out of the car. It's Friday, then. Like, that made it so popular again.
I mean, that record in so many different iterations.
When did the original come out?
The original come out, and I'm going to say 1994. It was, now this, okay, this is a story for us. So MK, Mark Kitchen, that's a remix of a Scottish band called Nightcrawlers. That even that melody is not in the original. He wrote that as part of the remix. And that blew up. So I don't think Mark, apart from his initial remix fee, has ever seen a penny more. That's when you remix it. This is you know, the issue that it can be, unless you negotiate some element of publishing, which is tough to do on a remix. But that has blown up so many times and made the original Nightcrawlers band so much money. I mean, I guess they paid him, I have no idea. Mark, you probably hit me up and let me know. Let's say they paid him $3,000 back in the day, which is a lot of money. That's made them millions.
Mm-hmm.
Because they own it. They own the master side, they own the master and the publishing side of it. You've just done a brilliant job of spinning it, but we own the original piece of music.
That's so mental.
That has been, and that record has been sampled so many times. That was a great piece of A&R skill commissioning that remix, let me tell you, for the band.
What, because you've done a few remixes, and obviously a lot of artists do remixes. Why would you want to remix an existing song instead of just going off and doing your own song?
It's a fair point. Sometimes there's a record you just love, and you think, do you know what? I can spin this in a way that makes sense. That has to be the driver of taking on a project. You think, hey, will this fit into my life? So is this something I can add to this project? I mean, people end up doing remixes for almost mercenary. They go, I'm going to pay this amount of money. And you think, there's no way with the component parts in this record, you can do something in line to what you stand for musically. Mm. I've just remixed Curtis Mayfield, Move On Up. So when you get asked to remix a record that's a classic like that, they're just, they're golden opportunities. Or things you just think, do you know what? Yeah, I can just elevate this record and move it into another space that would have a different audience and make sense for me. It complements what I do. So
are you getting asked to do it?
Yeah, you get asked to do it, yeah.
So you don't, is it a bit of both? Like, yeah, you might like a song and be like, I can make it better and put my spin on it. And then you get other people saying, hey, do you want to remix my song?
Yeah, you'll get, like, for example, we commission mixes all the time. We'll have a record and we're like, in its original format, it does this, but we think it would translate with the parts into also this world. So we'll go, look, can we pay you to do something in your style so it dances at that party and dances at that party and therefore generates more exposure for the record and more revenue opportunities. Mm. Where you take a record outside of you know, oh, I love this Gene Kahn record, I'm going to just remix it. You can then go back to the label and say, look, I've done this, would you pay me? Or then you can go to them and say, look, I've sampled it, it's now my production, would you clear the sample? So they're two different kind of things. But I get asked to do remixes all the time, and you can't do too many because it does rob you of a lot of inspiration. I remember when I initially started as an artist, I was so skint. I ploughed every penny I had into the studio. We had to take on a load of remixes. Me and my partner at the time, Martin, we worked together. We did about 20 remixes in a row one year, and it just killed us. They were brilliant. We did Sandcastles. We did a whole bunch of stuff that massively elevated our profile because we piggybacked on bigger eyes and therefore give us more exposure. But we then came to do our own record. We're like, fuck, there's nothing left. We've given it, all of our best ideas were given away. There's nothing in the tank. And it made us and broke us all in one go. So remixes are, it's about just picking the moments within your kind of release schedule to say, okay, there in the year, I could go and do a remix, I could go and do something. You know, I've got a gap in my productions, but primarily it's, you know, I think it's better to concentrate on your own productions. There's more longevity with content that you own yourself.
I can imagine it is, it's a great way to build your own following and awareness. If you can already find a very popular track and somehow work your magic and make it even better.
Yeah, for sure.
Then boom, like everyone's like, fuck, remix that, like shit.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. If you pick the right thing and you add the magic to it, then yeah, it's a quick win.
Mm. Where's your favorite clubs in the world to play at?
Oh, wow.
Where'd be the best?
I mean, I love playing in Bulgaria. I'm not going to lie. I love playing out there. It's unbelievable. I love playing in America and Canada, anywhere in North America at the moment. I'd probably say there right now. I mean, the scene's so hot and buoyant. It's incredible. It's like it was here in the late 90s, early 90s. There's that amount of enthusiasm and passion. It's still growing.
Is that a recent thing in America?
Yeah, in the last 10 years, it's really just blown up.
Yeah.
And it's still, you know, it's still going. There's still huge cities in America that really haven't got a scene yet that are going to happen. So there's so much potential there. You know, there was always that old saying, if you're a band, just, you know, if you make it in America, you make it. Because I could stop playing anywhere else in the rest of the world and just play in America and just have a career playing city to city to city because it's so big.
Mm.
And I have to say the enthusiasm out there is brilliant, where it's a little bit tainted here. It's become a bit tribal and more about image than the love of music. I have to say, where they still uphold that as a real passion and a real driver, it's a great place to go and play.
Who are the DJs at the moment who you like sort of respect the most, have the most admiration for?
I guess Carl Cox, just because he's, you know, he's such a nice guy and he's just stood behind his theme through thick and thin, you know. I've got massive respect for that. He, again, another guy who does things purely driven by love. You can feel that about his energy. Everything is passion driven. And again, the same thing with Louis Vega. He's, you know, he's very much in vogue now, rightfully so. I mean, he's been doing it for 25, 30 years, stood behind what he stood for forever and ever, and absolute master of it. So I guess those guys. Mm-hmm. The one thing you don't get to do enough of, and it's wrong really, is see other artists play, because you're so busy doing your own thing, and then you've got to try and balance it with life and family and other things. You don't really get the opportunities to go and see enough people when you get a career, and that's wrong really, because you need to go and pick up that inspiration. That, I guess that's the one failing in me, is that I don't go and see enough artists play and get inspired by them. It gets tougher when you get older and you've got family, you've got responsibilities, I've got a bunch of businesses as well that take up a lot of my time. But so I'm probably not the best in the world to answer that question, but Louis and Carl for me.
Does Carl, because he had the residency at Space in Ibiza, and then Space changed to High, new ownership, and then because of that, did he stop? Very quickly, guys, I just want to ask you a quick question. Are you taking supplements? And if you are, do you have any idea if you're taking the right supplements in the right amounts? You see, the more that I discovered about the importance of micronutrient supplementation and the adverse health effects of micronutrient deficiencies, I would constantly ask myself the same thing. I would go into supplement stores, load up on bottles of micronutrients, and pop pills daily without really knowing if they were doing me any good or not. That's when I decided to try out Bionic. Since 2021, I've been getting my blood work done with them every 3 to 4 months. And once the blood test has been analyzed, they would put together a customized micronutrient formula tailored specifically for me. And this would last me for 3 to 4 months until I got my blood work done again. And since then, I've honestly never looked back. If you are also serious about performing at your best, preventing development of diseases and maximizing your overall health and well-being, I highly recommend you give it a try. And they've recently introduced Bionic Go, which is a fraction of the price, where all you need to do is just fill in a questionnaire online without the need of a blood test. If you want to find out more or give them a try, head over to bionic.com, but you can use my exclusive referral code BQMikeThurston for a discount on your first order. Let's get back to the episode.
Yeah, he had a very, he was very tight with Pepe, the guy who owned Space. I don't know the full politics behind it, but
there's a lot of weird politics at Ibiza.
Welcome to Ibiza, right? You know, who understands that? Good luck.
I'm looking to try and speak to Jan.
Right, Jan's a great, I mean, they're some really great guys doing really great jobs. And Jan particularly, what they've done with that is, you know, brought clubbing into the next generation, fair play to them. Kept the island alive and buzzing and moving forward. So I've got a lot of time.
I feel like playing and boss has been almost transformed. Like just from High and then Ushuaia, and then he's opened Player Soleil.
Yeah.
Like you can just feel it's getting a makeover.
Absolutely. And you know what they're going to do with Privilege now?
Oh, yeah.
Bought that. So, you know, respect fucking to hell. Those guys. Yeah. Yeah.
Privilege, it was the biggest club on the island.
Oh, man. Yeah. Matt, it's, like, you know, played there a bunch of times. Yeah. When it's packed, it's mad.
Fuck. So, I mean, yeah, it'd be, I'm going to try my best. I was speaking to him last year, but he's extremely busy.
He's a very busy man. I need to catch him in the summer
before,
months.
Before, like, absolutely. April.
Winter's your time for Jan and those guys. Yeah.
Who do you know, like, in the DJing world, who is like the best paid DJ?
Probably David or Tiesto, I'd say.
Still Tiesto?
Yeah. And oh. Tice loves it, man. Again, someone, love, top guy. Again, I've never met anyone who loves DJing so much. He would play every day, 365 days of the years, if he could. And because he just loves it. I mean, you know, he's not getting
Tiesto
any...
Tiesto or David?
Tiesto, yeah. He just loves it. Yeah. Good luck to him, man.
And when you're DJing, this is one thing I was always curious to know about, because I thought at one point, oh, maybe I could be a DJ. And then I used to see the lifestyle and the hours that they would have to play. Like, that would completely screw up with my sleep routine, my gym routine. Like, how... I'm assuming you're the majority of the time now you're DJing sober. Like, did he used to get...
You know, let's not kind of box that into a statement like that. You know what I mean? No, I pick and choose my moments, of course. But I don't play that much anymore now. I play once or twice a month, and that works for me. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the measure of success isn't playing 18 times a month. In fact, quite the quite opposite. We have so many issues with mental health in our industry, and that's, I think, the biggest driver of that, that we've fashioned this scenario that success means you're playing three times a weekend. It really doesn't. It really doesn't mean that, because it will kill you. It will eat you up, spit you out.
And you're just surrounded by all these people who are no doubt saying, like, come on, time to go to the after party now.
All of the above, you know, because you've flown the other side of the world. They want to give you a great time. You've got to catch a flight at 6 o'clock in the morning and do the same thing for the next 2 days. It's a very dangerous world built on a ridiculous foundation. So I only DJ 2-3 times max a month. And that's great. That works for me. I really look forward to it. I can balance my life. You know, I can be healthy. I can go and have fun, enjoy it. You know, it's life... Winning in life is when you do all the things you love in the right amounts.
Yeah, balance. You
know, balance. That's winning. Yeah. Winning isn't playing 18 times a month. That's killing yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I can see why some of the artists are doing it, like, you know, Black Coffee, people like that. They're getting flown to all these places in private jets. They're probably getting, like, hundreds of thousands of dollars a set. Like,
there is
It would be, like...
That helps.
It's hard to... Because I was trying to think, if I was in their situation, you know, you get to do something you love to do, just play music to thousands of people for a lot of fucking money. So it's like you're constantly getting all these offers because it's a big world. There's a lot of clubs.
Absolutely.
How do you, it's like, oh, 300 grand. Like, I kind of just want to chill with my family.
Tuesday? Go on then. absolutely. Look, I was there, like, pre my son, and when he was very young, I was there, you know, I was doing 30 gigs in August, but the older you get, the more you realise there's so much to life.
Yeah.
You know, life isn't just about doing one thing, because you come that narrow as a person. Mm. You know, I've always been more than that. And it's...
I remember being a club promoter, and you're surrounded by, there's definitely a specific type of people, and it is a bit...
Narrow. It's not the healthiest environment, you know. We all can all fill in the blanks. So I think there's a time and a place to turn that on. And I think if you can work your career to a point where you can afford yourself that as an opportunity, and then I think it's wise to do so. I mean, it's taken me a while to get to that point, but I was always striving for that. I mean, the big thing I always worried about getting into it was like, how do I get out of it? So we're going in. It's all good fun then when you're, you know, 25, 26, running around the world. How do I get out? And how do I get out gracefully? Like, no one wants to see the heavyweight boxer going and getting his head bashed in every week. Yeah. No one wants to see the DJ falling off the cliff, playing awful gigs when they had such great profiles. So I built the label alongside it as my exit strategy, as my plan B. Always had a plan B because that's smart. And I'm like, now I don't need financially to DJ.
Yeah.
I don't need, I do it because I love it again. And that puts me in a great place. I don't do it because I've got to pay the rent. I do it because I'm really looking forward to playing in New York next week. Mm-hmm. I'm really looking forward to going to LA. Not only am I doing something I love, I'm going somewhere great in the world, and I'm enjoying it. And I'm back, I feel I've kind of fallen in love with it again, because there does come a point, like anything, you become numb to it. You know, that impact, you lose it. Like, a lot of my friends are ex-premiership players and rugby players, and you say to them, do you miss the game? They're like, no. Like, what? No. How can you? You get to a point where you play so many games that walking out to Anfield loses its thing. And I never wanted DJing to become that. There were moments where, like, well, I'm done. I'm done now. I've said everything I need to say. And it's too much. It's too much to cope. The pressures of it, the balancing of your family and getting that right, which is, you know, fundamentally number one. And then, you know, I said, well, you know, I don't need, just back it off. Just back it off. Like, and, you know, enjoy being present. Most of my time is spent with my son and my family, running him around all over the country playing football, and that's the most important thing to me right now. And then I DJ for fun. Yes, I get paid, and I get to maintain the exposure I need to uphold my job within the label. But it's gone back to a place of where it began, of just fun, not a slog that it's in line with the hamster wheel of the rest of the industry, feeling like I've got to do 27 gigs this month to be relevant. No, I ain't.
Yeah. You can be more selective, and then it makes it more special, not only for you, but obviously the people in attendance as well.
Yeah, I think so. But even if it doesn't, it works for me.
Yeah.
And I'll go into that environment in a good place, ready to smash it, you know, not hanging at my ass, tired.
Imagine I was going to, like, your set, and you don't start till 1 or 2 in the morning.
And you're
already knackered.
Oh, man.
And you're like, fuck, I've got to do a 5-6 hour set.
It's great. Look, listen, I'm not digging up the road, mate. I mean, there's a lot of people who do a lot harder things than me. And I don't want to start moaning, because that would be the wrong. But every job has its graft. Every job has its challenge. And that sleep deprivation is massive. And especially when you're trying to run a business in line with that, you know, because I always want to lead from the front. I'm the captain of the team. I've got to put a captain's performance in. Don't matter if I'm playing in Sao Paulo on Saturday night, I've got to be the first in the office Monday morning.
Yeah.
Because if I can't, how am I going to expect that not to? And if that's a standard I set, that if I can be there, you live 20 minutes down the road, don't be late. Don't be late. I'll have the kettle on, but don't be late. You know what I mean? And we created that culture, and the people that work in my office are just incredible. I'm where I am at because of my team. You know, there's no eyes. It's we, and it's the team. But it's about setting that precedent of the standards you expect. And look, we play hard, we play really hard, and we work hard, and then we live life to the fullest. So.
How big is the team now?
33.
Nice.
Yeah, and they're all incredible. They are, you know, I'd die for them. They're brilliant.
HQ in London.
The HQ's in Maidstone in Kent. Okay. So we're based out there. But props to the team, they're brilliant.
Yeah. What have you got coming up in 2024? Any big gigs that you're looking forward to?
Yeah, we've got a whole in terms of the label, I guess the next big thing, we've got a big pool party in Miami at WMC. That'd be great. We do one every year there.
I need to go to that before I get too old.
Well, you never get too old for Miami, let me tell you.
Do you feel like the crowd there is a little bit older? Because sometimes when I go to, when you are like selective with the nights that you go to, say, for example, in Ibiza, you can find a lot of people like same age as me, even older. Like there's nights to have the old crowd, there's nights to have the younger crowd.
Yeah. Oh, listen, we're living through a very interesting time right now in the evolution of electronic music, because we are going through, in my eyes, the next phase of it. We had everyone, because I'm a little bit older than you, when we used to go out back in the day, a lot of my friends stopped going out because we all had kids and, you know, settled down. They're like, well, look, I'm 50 and I'm not ready to jet, you know, I'm not, don't need slippers and a pipe and an old people's home. I've still got a bit in the locker, mate. And you've got all these...
The hips still move.
They're still going. Okay, it's the third hip I've had. But, you know what I mean? There are nights now that are relative to certain age group, which is great, because why should it end? Why does it need to end when you're 40 or 50? Why should it? You know, it's. I guess it's about being comfortable in the environment you're in. But yeah, I mean, there's some nights that are, I guess, for an older crowd out there. Loads and lots of kids there, which are great because it continually moves the scene on. It's brilliant. And like I say, the enthusiasm in America is off the charts. So that's good. Then we've got shows in LA, Vancouver, Boston, New York, Bali. A big show in London on the 15th of May, is it? Something like that. Yeah. Ministry. So yeah, we've always got loads going on. There's always something happening.
Is that in Surabaya, the one in Bali?
It is at Atlas.
Okay.
One there just before Christmas. It's brilliant. It's enormous there, by the way. What a place that is.
It's funny because as I've got older, I still like to go to a party. I definitely drink less because I can't hack that anymore. But I really appreciate like the daytime parties and the early evening ones where it kind of finishes at 12,
Mark, 1. You are getting old, mate. Do you know what I mean? Can you get Mike a bit of a blanket? He's getting a bit chilly now as well.
No, you go out with a Zimmer frame.
It's true. That's become a thing now, which is great. I mean, it's just new iterations and evolutions. Day parties in London are the biggest thing at the moment. We're doing a big daytime show at Coco in October, which is great, again, because you are done by 12, by sometimes 10 o'clock, which is brilliant. You're back for match of the day. Everyone's a winner.
Speaking of football, you start a new business venture.
I have, yes. Yeah. Segue nicely into that. Yes, it's called Ballers. It's a project that I've started with some footballers, Bobby Zamora, Rio Ferdinand, Mark Noble, and some really, and a guy called Nick and Danny. It's first sight is at Blue Water, which is just outside of town. It's a football experience. It's kind of multifaceted experience. It's a huge dome. It's got a 7-a-side pitch. And when you play on the pitch, you've got all big screens around it, so you get real-time playbacks of your goal. You come out the tunnel to the music. When you score, all the effects go, all the lights go off. When you finish, you get all your highlights emailed to you. You get a heat map of what you've done, all your stats. So it's kind of like football on steroids. And then indoors, you've got a skill zone where we've got a target wall. We've got head tennis. We've got all this incredible tech, these brilliant football games. So we are running it to sort of facilitate football at every level. In the daytime, we've got little kickers, little ballers, should I say. We've got walking football, we've got community stuff, we've got special needs stuff. We have then got local football, we're running our own academy out of there. And then at weekends, it's for parties, hire it for a party, kids' parties. You come in, you do a bit in the skill zone, you go out on the pitch. It's incredible. Get a chance, look up, go to our Instagram page, Ballers. It's very exciting. It's brilliant.
This is the first one's going to be in London.
First site opens in May, on the 17th of May. Really excited for that. We're already in talks with two other venues as well, two other sites, which is great because I'm finally doing the two things I always wanted to do, football and music. So it's exciting. It's great to take all the kind of acumen and understanding you've got through business in one world and then transfer it into something else. And then again, in something you're massively passionate about. So I'm loving every minute of it at the moment.
Is Rio Ferdinand's involved with that as well?
Yeah, Rio's involved, Bobby and Mark. And yeah, and big up to Nick and Danny as well, and Parker and Ben and all the guys that are making it work. And Sam as well. Great team behind that, brilliant team. All top lads and top projects. It's so excited for it to launch and people to come and see it because it is a one of a kind.
Nice, man. Thank you. I appreciate that. Keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you, mate. And, thank you for having me.
Everyone can find you. Just search for DJ Mark Knight.
At DJ Mark Knight. Yeah, all the same. All Instagram, Twitter, all that stuff is all just the same. Yeah, come and follow me running around the world doing stuff.
And buy the songs from Correct. Tool Room. Stop downloading illegally.
There's one thing you're going to take away from that today. Hopefully it's that. Because it helps emerging talents. It helps us scene. If you're a fan of music, then, you know, just do the right thing. Subscribe to Spotify or Apple. It's pittance. And you've got every record ever made. Not a bad deal.
And check out my playlist as well. Ibiza House Music 2024.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much,
Brilliant.
Mark.
Thanks, Mark. Nice one, mate.